I've had moments in my life when I felt as if the choice I was facing was almost cosmic in its significance. And about 2 weeks later, I'd lost all interest in it. I've had other moments in my life when I very nearly said no to something, then I thought, oh no, I'll do it, and that changed my life. Not least the decision to accept a speaking engagement that led to the point where I met my wife 25 years ago this year. It's strange stuff, this guidance business. It's quite frightening to think you could have just missed it because actually you just felt you didn't want to take it on. You're nodding, you're relating to this. This is not straightforward stuff. There are no straight lines in this kind of stuff because there are no straight lines in God's kingdom. This is the Ryanair approach. This is the picture I love best. Have you come across it? The road less taken, the road less traveled by. This figure slightly out of focus. Do they know what they're doing? I have a print of this on my wall at home, and it's a kind of barometer picture. If I look at it and I just see the shadows and the out of focus and the slightly bent, uncertain figure, that tells me actually usually how I'm feeling a bit about life and whether God's around or not. Other times, there's the gold, there's the swirlies, there's the sense of being part of an extraordinary story that's beyond what I can grasp, but it's amazing to be drawn into it and renewed in it. And that's when I'm feeling good, and God's a bit more obviously around and on the page. It's actually called walking with angels. I often use it at the beginning of reflection days with people in ministry, and I'm not going to do this to you now, but I start by saying, if this was you in this picture, what would you be feeling like? What would be going on? What would your story be? What words might describe how you're feeling? And often there is this mixture of the kind of gold and the shadows, the positives and the uncertainties, the vulnerabilities. And no two groups are the same. But it's always what we bring into the room at the start of the conversation. So it's just quite important to log that's where we are. The Church of England, the church in this land, facing immense challenges. Getting the message clear is one of them. Something about priorities. Something about leadership. Something about theology. Can you read that? Jesus saying, please listen carefully, I don't want to end up with four versions of this. This one's about survival. You need to look carefully at this one. And did you know PDF is now the fourth most popular religion in this country? We're facing serious competition here. How do I convert to PDF? Is a question everyone's asking. Okay. It doesn't get much better than this, I warn you. I took the road less travelled. Now, where the hell am I? Where are we starting? There's not a flip chart here, is there? No. Is there a quick flip chart? That would be a real help, just very quickly, thank you. While that's arriving, this is about the whole business of change and transition. A world in ferment. We're travelling in all sorts of directions at once. Would you, just where you're sitting, think of an experience you've had of change? You won't have to tell anyone else what it is, so don't get anxious. It could be big time. It could be very trivial. It could be something you're going through at the moment. It could be something back in past. But just think of a few words that describe that experience of change. And in a moment, I'd like to just log the words on the flip chart, just to get some sense of a range of what you're responding to. So just take a moment to think. Thank you. Sorry, I meant to check with the flip chart beforehand. Is it coming? There it comes. Okay, this is an experience of change. Could be large or small. Could be recent or in the past. And I'm asking you, please, in a moment, thanks ever so much, Guy. In a moment, just to flag up, just to call out a word or a phrase at the most, no more than that. Thank you. Brilliant. Could you? Yes. Okay. Thank you so much. Marvellous. The road to growth. Flip chart is part of the strategy for growth. It's required in the kingdom of God. In the canons of the Church of England, you should always have a flip chart. So something went wrong this morning. It's there. Words, please. Just call them out. It expresses the experience of change for you.
Surprise.
On one sheet, that'd be great. So just scroll around. Just scroll around. How are we doing? Any others? One more? Thank you. That's plenty. There'll be more we can add to it. So just notice in it how quickly we've expressed, thank you so much, we've expressed a huge range of stuff there. You know, don't you? This is what makes life difficult and possible and exciting and mysterious and vulnerable, facing change. Now, I want to suggest to you, though, if I may, I haven't been trying to muck you around or catch you out. But change is not the same as transition. They belong together. I asked you for an experience of change. What I want to suggest is you've given me words that express the experience of transition. Now, what do I mean by that? By the word change, I think we mean, and this is what leaders tend to mean, it's what's going on out there. So if you've moved house, or change jobs, the physicality of it, a new region, a new network of friends, a new church, what day you put the wheelie bins out, you know, all the kind of out there-ness of it. That's what I think I mean by change. Transition is about our inscape. If change is about the outer landscape, transition is about what has to adapt within us if we're to live well and flourish with what has changed out there. Does that make sense? And you will immediately grasp then, I think, why this is important. Because when you look at these words, ask for an experience of change, you've mapped what the change required of you in your soul and your sense of being and identity and flourishing and excitement. Yes, this is good. No, this is ghastly. I hope this gets better, all that stuff. So whenever any change is going on, and we talk about growth, that is change. When we talk about strategy, that is change. Whenever any change is going on, all this stuff is in the room. So where does that take us? Well, a little bit further. Change is about our beginnings. It's where we're going. And this is where the leaders of change and strategy and growth are focused. It is the work of leadership to have a vision for the future. That's not wrong. Transition is about our endings. It's where we're coming from. One of the things I've noticed in long experience in local church and working as a consultant and things is how often churches survive generation after generation of fizzy dynamic leadership and still manage to sort of, they don't even regress. They hadn't changed, actually. Just a sort of this layer of energetic growth stuff goes on. 6 years later, another vicar or pastor comes. They all go through the same process again. But the actual transformation is much more elusive than that. And usually what's happened is that the transitional needs of that community have not been attended to and listened to. And it's possible then for communities to have quite a deep level of unexpressed grief about all the challenges and stuff they've been going through. They may well know the need to change at some profound level. But actually, this is all the stages of bereavement, actually. This is good care in the place of significant human loss. We need somewhere to name all this. We need somewhere to know this is heard and honoured, precisely what it is we're having to let go of. It may be good stuff still, but there may be entirely appropriate reasons why we can't journey with it anymore. So the care with which we let go of things is part of the process that frees us for the future. Quite a lot of what's going on in this land, in church life, is actually beneath the surface. There's immense grief and anxiety. You can't just push communities like that into growth. You can't just force them into change. And my goodness, unless transitional needs are faced, the resistance of local communities that otherwise look totally fragile and vulnerable, the resistance is extraordinary, the strength that can be generated, the heels dug in. It just won't happen. Am I making sense here? Am I overstating? I sense you connecting with it. So this is actually really important stuff. And some of what I want to explore as we go through this morning is about how these change and transition live in a more flourishing and healthy and nurturing relationship with each other. It's not either or. It's not one personality or another. It is about the partnership we need, and there is no one script for it. Let me suggest there are a number of givens that we work with today. Perhaps we can agree this. Firstly, we're in unfamiliar country. Doesn't matter how long you've lived in this part of the country geographically, the Christian church in this land is in a very unfamiliar place, having been for hundreds of years at the center of its shaping and its values and its regard and being respected. We just now feel increasingly marginalized, don't we? I think it's almost an experience at times of a kind of internal exile, although I don't use that word lightly, because there are many for whom it's much more profound and costly. But a faith that's so closely identified with the story of this land, not least its achievements and its victories and its empire and everything else, it's a complex identification. An established church needs quite a bit of redeeming of its identity, it seems to me. There's quite a lot about the privileges of being close to the corridors of power and the great and the mighty in this land that I think the Church of England has grown far too comfortable with over the years. There is something redeeming about simply not being honoured there anymore. It makes possible an authentic discipleship again, I think. But it is painful, and we do still need to try to get the voices in there. We're urgently seeking new ways to be address a culture that's adrift from any spiritual roots and is unable to recognise its loss. So in the face of steady decline, there's all sorts of imaginative strategies going on, and I imagine you in your own life and your church life are part of that. Emergent, fresh, liquid, pioneer, cafe, it's all still going and there's new stuff still arriving. It's brave, it's imaginative, there's energy out there. I'm really grateful for the voices that are coming in and the places where this kind of stuff is being discussed. And where at a local church level, it's making a difference. In small ways, stuff is changing, it is working. There's a lot to give thanks for. I trust that is part of your story at some level. But it's exploratory, it's vulnerable, and it doesn't just immediately work, does it? It's not a problem-solution culture that we're in. So we're an unfamiliar country. There's a loss of landmarks. I'm speaking particularly out of my own Anglican Church of England tradition here, but it's true for the other traditions too. Our spiritual roots are so deeply interwoven into the culture and history of this land, we are struggling to imagine ourselves in any other way. We don't know what we look like, except in this historic network of established relationships, and they are not there in the same way now, nor, I think, is God asking them to be there. There's a loosening and a letting go that actually, I think, my word is redeeming. I think that's what it's about. But it's very vulnerable, and it's vulnerable precisely because of God, not because of what ghastly secularists are doing to us. I want to suggest to you that the greatest challenge in any age is always God. It's not them. It's not what they're doing to us, or they being apathetic, or they ignoring us. The greatest crisis in every age is always theological. Now that seems to be foundational. If we believe God is at the centre of all this, then of course this is true. So something of the uncertainty and the vulnerability is the life of God and the Spirit, working, drawing, compelling, redeeming, purifying, prizing our hands off certain ways of knowing ourselves that never were actually that kingdom based. But even more now, we need to come to a new identity and a new birth. We're also, we've been identified for hundreds of years with everything that's solid and secure and unchanging, and all the kind of Victorian confidence in God's overruling sovereignty in the seasons. We sing about it at the cenotaph every year. Oh God, our help in ages past. This firm confidence, time like an ever-flowing stream, generation by generation. I don't think it works like that. Time clots around wounds and things. It doesn't just flow through history. We get stuck. Whole generations and communities skirt around all sorts of no-go areas. That's partly why we're in such paralysis politically at the moment with Brexit. We don't even know how to begin to have the conversations we most need for our own core values anymore. It's a serious problem. Some years ago, a psychologist in the States called Philip Cushman wrote a paper, it was just a short paper actually, called Why the Self is Empty. And he made the point that we only know ourselves as human beings. He wasn't writing as a Christian, but he's absolutely, this is a core Christian insight. We only know ourselves as human beings in community. You call me by name. You draw me into my sense of who I am. I call you by name. There is no David Runcorn who sorts himself out and his values and beliefs and then comes like all you do, and together we make some sort of community. It all happens in the way we call each other into being. Now, what is happening in our societies and cultures, in particularly in the Western world, is a steady collapse. It's not just the church. It's a steady collapse of all the organizations and institutions and social groupings and networks that have mediated to us generation by generation our sense of who we are, have preserved and conveyed the values by which we live and the things we most cherish and the meanings that we feel are core to our existence and the way we want to present ourselves to the world. Now, if all those start to collapse, and it's happening politically, socially, almost all organized institutions in this culture now, alongside the church, are fragmenting. When those collapse, where do we go for our sense of who we are? It's not available in here somewhere. I am not an individual. I only know myself in a becoming in the midst of a web of relationships. So what Philip Cushman was noting from the American standpoint, but it's true here too, is that the self is empty because there is no longer anywhere a container socially that holds me, calls me by name, calls me into being, mediates to me and teaches me what is core to being human and thus something of my own vocation within it. He says the result is psychologically and emotionally chronic undifferentiated hunger. We're ravenous for some sense of where to belong. And that is why consumerism is primarily a psychological problem before it's an economic one. You just take what you can to fill up the emptiness. That's consumerism. And that's why consumptive and addictive disorders are so rampant in our society. We're desperately looking for somewhere to fill our hunger. This is quite complex and vulnerable stuff, and it's something much more profound than about the survival of the church. We've got to let that go. This is nothing to do with the survival of the church. This is about the life of God in Christ redeeming all this fragmented stuff at a really critical and painful and vulnerable time in our world and society. The loss of landmarks, the loss of place. It won't surprise you to hear me say that I think there are limits in such a context. There are limits to what strategies can do. I like to think of strategies as a bit like scaffolding. The purpose of scaffolding is to create a safe shape within which the real stuff can happen. The danger is if you mistake the scaffolding for the real stuff. The scaffolding, there's a certain pragmatism about scaffolding. We trust that with this shape and design, some real building up can happen. And it may well be so. But we need to recognize they are not solutions as such. They offer a flawed container within which the real journeying must happen, something that is actually much more vulnerable. I quite like this quote from Antoine de Saint-Exupéry. If you want to build a ship, don't drum up the people to gather wood, divide the work, and give orders. Instead, teach them to yearn for the vast and endless sea. Isn't that wonderful? Of course it's true. We're not just giving people more jobs to do, which is what happens with a lot of strategies. You've probably got sucked into endless committees like I have. That's what happens with strategies. But unless somewhere in the process is just awakening a longing that makes me yearn and will channel all my priorities and energies that this is where I must be. I yearn for it. I long for it. This is about desire. God has made us creatures of desire. And that is where it begins to take life. And that is where we'll be prepared and we'll find the resources to make the sacrifices the journey needs. Then there's the perils of what I call relevance. There's a certain pragmatism can take over in communities that feel threatened for their survival. You go to where you think something will make a difference and will give you some sense of survival, give you some means of going on. It means everything, by and large, is measured for its usefulness. This is, you won't be able to see this, it's not a very good photo in the first place. Some years ago, on the coastline of Honduras, there still is a huge silted estuary where massive rivers converge and go out into the sea. Of course, for generations, it just chronically divided the country, whole cities. And because it was a silted estuary, there was not even a straightforward way of putting a ferry system across the whole thing. So finally, they got funding, and they built this enormous road bridge right the way across, and spanning the middle with the river going through the middle of it, this massive road bridge several miles long. Just a month after the road bridge was opened, with great ceremony, sight, and hope, there was a massive tornado came through the whole system. And overnight, the river changed course. They ended up with this huge road bridge over no river at all. It wasn't relevant anymore. The perils of relevance are, in a fast-changing culture, that as soon as you've got the language and you've got something, they love this, they'll come for this, they've gone on. Someone described, a psychologist I know, described our culture as living on the compass of our excitement, living on the compass of our excitement. So wherever the compass goes, whew, I like that, I'm going after that, then the needle changes. We're restless, we're overstimulated. That's what it's about. Try to base the strategy on relevance. We're in real trouble. And as soon as we've done all the fizzy stuff and the PowerPoint, the social media, everything else, suddenly, oh, they're into that now. We know the problem, don't we? We're as restless as they are too. So there are problems with restlessness, offering a restless, rootless church to a restless, rootless world. And then there's something about anxiety. I'm very influenced by a writer called Ernest Friedman. Have I put it on the back of the handout? Is it a book called A Failure of Nerve, Leadership in an Age of Quick Fix. He died just 2 years ago. He was an international business consultant, a pulpit rabbi, and a family systems therapist, psychotherapist. Really interesting mix of stuff. And there's really sharp wisdom in what he writes. But one of the things he says is, there is anxiety is now the driver of in Western culture. And by that, he doesn't just mean we tend to be rather anxious and worry a lot. He means it's in the DNA. It actually is what shapes our decisions and the way we function. And because anxiety is painful, we will do anything we can to allay it. So it means our approach to leaders, for example, becomes messianic, because we desperately need leaders who can solve the problems and take us through, whether it's growth or flourishing, anything else. We have huge expectations of our leaders. One of the things I noticed, and you probably have too, it certainly was apparent in Brexit. We're seeing it with Trump in the States. Actually, on a lot of church websites and things where there's discussions going on, is just how fast the debates become aggressive and intolerant. There's a coarsening of public discourse that's been going on now for a few years. It's almost cartoon-like in the States at the moment, but it's happening in our culture. But I actually see it when I'm trying to join in on some of the discussion threads and things on church websites and stuff, the national ones, how quickly it suddenly, after a while, it's as if we just can't quite cope with negotiating difference, and all of a sudden it starts getting personal, a bit insulting and sweeping and caricaturing. It's quite disturbing. There are very few places now that are hospitable and that can hold the differences for long enough to make real meeting possible. I'll push on a little bit more, if I may, and then I'd like to make a pause, because we're covering a lot of stuff very quickly, and you may be bursting to make a response, and I hope you are. That's about anxiety. And the last point I want to make in this section is the struggle for depth. You won't be surprised to hear me say this. These are very difficult times in which to live at any kind of depth. Partly because we just don't feel we've got the time to invest in it. And one of the things about living at depth is you've got to go out of sight for quite a long time. And you've got to be willing to go into the dark for quite a long time. And you don't know when you've dug enough. You may not know where you're ending up. It's a whole different way of navigating. There's a whole approach to darkness, which in the scriptures is a very core place for seeking wisdom, which is another strand you're exploring here, and I wish I could be at. Really profound, very important. Living at depth, I know it can feel a bit of a cheap thing. We always should be praying more. We always should be doing more retreats. We know that. I'm not just trying to hammer something at this point. I just want to make the statement that quite a lot of what goes on because of the anxiety, because of the need that we feel is there, it flows on at a very fast surface level of pragmatism. And that's what makes the discussion about depth difficult in a lot of meetings about strategy. We all know it's important. We're not sure we've got the time for it. This is the Bishop of Liverpool. We can be an anxious and hasty church running away from our fears in decline. If we're not careful, we'll rush into initiatives and schemes for growth with no depth, no reflection, no root in prayer. We talk and talk about fresh expressions and new beginnings, and indeed God is drawing us there, but we need to know about community and faithfulness if that talk is to be true and to bear fruit in changed lives. I'm going to pause at this moment. I'm quite happy if we sit silent for a few minutes, actually. We maybe need to, but there is a lollipop mic here. Are there things any of you would like to lob in at this point from your own wisdom and experience, points of engagement or challenge or disagreement? Or we just sit quietly. Please don't just speak for the sake of it. Wave a hand if you'd like to contribute.
Thank you for that wonderful talk. And I just would like to say that as an A-level teacher, the topic you've just discussed with us is actually what I experience in the classroom with the young people I work with. And yes, the impact of the church is going down and down and down. And the students are starting to get disheartened of what religion is all about, because they can't see the vision ahead. And as you said, because we focus on the how to build boat, we miss the point of what is the boat is for. you know, purpose and meaning of it. So I just would like to say thank you for that. It's very enlightening.
Thank you very much. That's very helpful. There's one behind you, Alan.
Thank you. I was very struck by what you said. I'd like to just offer a few thoughts on work, because it's actually a very major part of people's lives. And work used to give people, it did actually give them meaning and dignity and status. Yeah. So that I knew a man who was a grinder. A grinder is a big man because he takes big pieces of casting and turns them and holds them. And you were respected if you were a grinder. Yeah. I guess there aren't any grinders anymore. In fact, if you are apprenticed, like a friend of mine was, to become a cooper and spend 7 years learning to shape wood, and then just as you've qualified, they bring in aluminium barrels. And I think the pain in our society where people talk about a flexible workforce, which basically means you're going to invest a lot of yourself in becoming something, and then every 10 years we're going to take it away from you. That's not being acknowledged at all politically.
I think you're absolutely right. I think it's extremely painful. And yes, it strikes at the core of who we are, because you're both speaking about work and very creatively, the creating of things, the shaping of things, the way you've described it. And instead, we're being driven into these productivity. I've done workshops with this, and people have come up after, you could be describing my workplace. This is how my office feels. It's like a wilderness. It's like a desert. It's just, we're arid. We don't know why we're working so hard anymore and what values drive what we're doing. Thank you.
Sorry, just to close. And I see Brexit and Trump as the inarticulated cry of pain coming out of that.
Yes, that's true. Thank you. There's one behind you.
Did I hear you say that you weren't an individual? You made a statement in the context of society, you didn't think you were an individual. Or did I misunderstand?
Not completely, I did say that. But I think I know myself as an individual in community. That's what qualifies it. There is no standalone me that knows myself and then I come and meet you or anyone else. I always know myself in relationships. I think that's what being human means. I'm born out of a loving relationship with my parents. Just everything flows from that. Does that clarify?
Yes, I think the issue today, of course, is with the rise of social media, that people immediately flock to a view that's expressed by lots of other people. And they don't necessarily have the courage to say what they think as an individual, because the message is that it's best to be part of a group. So, I mean, I'm quite keen on individuals.
I think that's a really important point. My question is where that strength of who I am comes from. And it does come from a core-centered community still. What you're describing on social media is just all over the place, isn't it? You're absolutely right there. It needs addressing.
I've discovered that people now who declare themselves atheists are afraid of any contact that might affect the church. I speak personally, my son-in-law is an atheist. my daughter is a believer, but he's a lovely man and he's a good, kind man. He does charitable things. He's a hard worker. But he's afraid of his son, he's only 12 weeks about, getting indoctrinated, so he doesn't want anything doing about a church or anything. It's a kind of fear which I don't understand, because before, maybe it's what's come up today, I don't know, but before it used to be that you might not believe yourself, but you'd leave a child or a family member to explore it yourself. But it seems like he's afraid of anything.
Thank you.
So I thought
that was important. Thank you. There's one more here. There's somewhere else. Then I'll chug on a bit more, if I may.
It was just a thought that occurred to me about changing. As leaders, we tend to see at the end of the journey, we focus on where we want to get to, and you've got all the people you're trying to motivate to move, they're taking the first step up a set of steps. Mm. And you're trying to motivate them to take that first step, whereas you're already at the end, and you have to be aware that for them the first step is the first step that they want to make, and it's difficult.
Yes, thank you. Was there one more? No?
Guide.
So, in the search for depth, to me there's a real sense in which that can often be seen as a need to recover the landmarks and to look backwards and to find those roots that you've lost. So depth can be equated with a return to what you used to have. And by temperament, I'm more of a forward-looking person, and I see it as my responsibility in leadership to be forward-looking. So the question I'm wrestling with this morning is, how do you combine depth with being forward-looking as opposed to seeing depth as equating with finding roots that you once had lost? Does that make sense? Mm.
Can we hold that? Because I think we're circling around that question, and it maybe we can take it a bit further in ongoing. It's a crucial one. And there's no straightforward answers to it. It's almost the awareness of what we need is part of the solution, because then we won't be tempted just to jettison it as a bit of a luxury. We're pausing at 15:15. We're having a refreshment comfort break at 15:15, so you can pace yourself. Is that all right? Are we doing okay? So just a little section now, and then I think this might be the point to pause, and we'll go in some different directions after the coffee break, if I may, before we stop. I know that, I think you've had someone on exile, haven't you? Have you had some material on exile at one of these lectures? Yes. I don't want to touch on this for very long, but I do in the book that I wrote on this. And I'm just intrigued that one of the names the early church gave for themselves when they wrote to each other and greeted each other was exiles. You get it in 1 Peter. It occurs in other parts of the New Testament. To the exiles of the dispersion in Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, chosen, destined, sanctified, grace and peace be yours. This is clearly a round letter written to a region the size of modern-day Turkey and beyond. And no one knows anything whatsoever about the churches named in this list. Two of them are named on the day of Pentecost, but we don't even know how they were pastored. We don't know where they learnt the faith. We're not sure whether Peter knew anything about them. It seems to have been a round letter that he sent to encourage and gather from what story he knew of what they were facing. We also know that region was, in the time of the Roman Empire, a huge market garden servicing the great city-states and cities of the empire. So there was, as you'd expect, and as you find in parts of this country, servicing that kind of economy, there was a huge community of disenfranchised, voteless, voiceless migrant workers working for the powers of the empire, servicing and meeting their needs. So when I used to read the description of the exiles, I used to tend to think, well, it means one day we'll be in heaven. So here, we're not really in our real home. So in that sense, it's a spiritual thing. Actually, there's some evidence for thinking he's actually talking about almost an economic identity at that point, economic migrants. These are people working, and without any land rights or anything else, working to serve the powers of the age and the comforts and needs economically and socially. So what if he's writing to a people whose lives are shaped by chosen or enforced mobility, vulnerable exile, and disorientating change at the whims of those who can actually control how they spend their time and what little money they earn. It's also known that in the New Testament, when there are echoes or actual quotes from the Hebrew Old Testament scriptures in the New Testament, the period of exile and Exodus is more quoted than any other parts of the Old Testament. So when the New Testament believers in that vulnerable, fragile, early emerging communities of faith around the empire, scattered wide, we know very little about many of them, quite clearly, when they wanted to find some name or designation or connection that helped them understand their vocation, it was to the exile literature they turned. That's where they found themselves. That's what made some sense of what they were up to and what they were doing and what it asked of them. But that also, theologically, is what gave them some sense of their identity in God and their vocation. This is really intriguing, it seems to me. And I think, as I said earlier, that the notion of exile is attracting and making sense to a lot of people in quite settled parts of the world. But I suggested earlier that certainly some of my experience of being church and Christian in this land, which for me has been a lifetime, is a kind of internal exile. And the points where they were connecting, even if they didn't believe I believed, we somehow respected. It was one of the voices in the public place, and it had its role, and at key moments in the life of the nation, there was a sense of valuing, and they even asked us to roll out the services or the memorials or anything else. And that all seems to be going. There's a sense of being pushed to the margins and not respected anymore. But I still do believe that our deepest exile always begins and ends with God. And I think that's what's going on in the New Testament literature. We are called, Jesus says, to a certain kind of homelessness, a certain kind of faithful rootlessness that is to do with journeying with the one who had nowhere to lay his head in this earth, in this life. One of the words that's used at the beginning of 1 Peter is parakoi, and it means variously migrant, sojourner, that sort of rootless figure. There's millions of them around the world today. As it was translated into Middle English, and you began to get translations from the Greek in very early Middle Ages English, it was an offlander. And an offlander was someone whose real homeland was somewhere else, and they hoped to return there one day, but there they were, living in a land that was not their own, rather like the exiles did in the time of Jeremiah and beyond around the city-states of Babylon. This then got translated through, and it's actually where we get the word parish from. The parakoi, the rootless migrant, is traceable to the word parishioner today. So Peter is writing to the parishioners. Isn't that bizarre? That a word that in the New Testament spoke of everything that was most rootless and transitory and vulnerable, but where they were called to learn to sing the Lord's song in a land that was not their own. Now the word parish expresses everything that's most solid, cemented, and fixed in our culture. Anyone trying to move a parish boundary, a yard in this nation, knows what I mean. Can't be done. What if our vocation is to recover something of the original meaning of what a parishioner is in New Testament terms? And if Peter was writing his epistle to us, to the parishioners in Harrogate and Leeds, Barnsley and beyond, wherever, how does that sound? What does that ask of us? If we resonate as far as we can with the original context of that circular letter, homeless, voiceless, marginalized, landless, living under the powers of the age, but in that strange land called to sing the Lord's song. This is Gordon Mersal. It is the exile's vision that can renew the cosmos. For only those who have, in some sense or other, stepped out in faith without knowing where they are going, are free enough from our obsession with security and control to dream a different world. It is always the migrant voice in any culture that challenges the values of the settled culture of their time. And it is always the tension of the migrant presence to say, do we assimilate or do we stay distinctive? The Jews have always struggled with that down the ages. Christians have struggled with it, and it's an important struggle to make. But what if it is good news that we simply can't anymore in our time hold on to the things that once defined us in this land? We are exiles. We're parishioners, rootless, shapeless, feeling our way, earning our way, learning to sing the Lord's song in a land that is strange and unfamiliar, that doesn't know how to greet or value us, is ambivalent about us, as settled societies always are about migrants. What if this is good news? And the secret of who we're becoming may yet be found here in the embracing of it. I'm going to suggest we pause there. Is that right? Slightly early, but how long a break have we got?
Fantastic. If we can
Thank you.